Recount of Monte Cristo. From Hollywood, the Mutual Network presents Carlton Young in The Yankee Clipper, another adventure in the exciting life of the Count of Monte Cristo. During the 19th century, two nations struggled valiantly to bring a democratic order of things to a despot-ridden globe. The United States with her freedom-endowed constitution, and France. France, who was fortunately blessed with a champion of right and justice, whose life was devoted to the welfare of the common man. For this champion was Edmond Dantès, the fabulous Count of Monte Cristo. Private chambers in the great palace of Versailles, a gravely troubled King Louis Philippe is in conference with the one man upon whose judgment he has always relied, in conference with the Count of Monte Cristo.
Briefly, Edmond, the situation is this. The government of the United States has secretly requested a tremendous loan from France. Ordinarily, there would be no question about granting it. But this, as you realize, is no ordinary situation.
You refer, sire, to the fact that the United States is virtually bankrupt.
Exactly, Ebon. Her greatest source of national income, her shipping trade with China and the Far East, has been practically cut off by the strong competition of the British East India Company. How could she ever pay such a loan?
And yet, were we not to help her, sire, we might be destroying a nation that has been more closely allied to ours than any other.
And there you have named the dilemma, Edmond. One which my ministers and I have found unsolvable.
Sire, as you know, I have but recently returned to France from a lengthy journey overseas. I beg leave to relate an adventure which befell me during those travels.
What is this, Edmond? I propound you one of the gravest diplomatic problems that has ever faced me, and you wish to answer with some tale of adventure?
I believe you will find that the tale has a very direct bearing upon the problem at hand, sire.
Very well, then, Edmond, on with it. But if you are trifling with my time...
You shall be the judge of that, sire, and I am confident of your verdict. It was about a year ago that my yacht dropped her anchor in the shipping town of Newburyport, Massachusetts, hard by to Boston. A matter of urgent business had brought me there. And that evening, at the home of Warren Banyan, head of the Banyan Trading Company, Lenny Mishaw and I discussed the situation with him. His lovely daughter, Maud, listened quietly and attentively nearby.
There's no use trying to conceal the facts, Count. The Banyan Trading Company's been losing money hand over fist. And as the heaviest investor in the firm, you are being hurt the most.
I am not as concerned with the loss of money, Monsieur Banyan, as I am with the reasons for it. The same reasons which are bringing the entire country to the verge of bankruptcy.
Aye, the British East India Company and its prior treaty rights in the Chinese ports.
As I understand it, Monsieur Banyan, those treaty rights entitle British ships to first choice of Chinese cargo.
That's the story, Mr. Michon. Our ships don't even get a look at trading goods till they... British have sailed away. So by the time we reach the market ports of the world, they've already glutted them with the latest Far East goods. Our cargoes have to be sold at a loss.
Oh, but surely there must be some solution to this problem.
There is a solution, Mr. Michon. But my father and the other shipowners stubbornly refuse to recognize it.
Maud, must I remind you again that the shipping business is not within the province of women?
And must I remind you, Father, that our country's welfare is everyone's business, regardless of sex?
Maud, I...
One moment, please, Mr. Banyan. Certainly, if your daughter believes she knows of a solution to this grave problem, she's entitled to a hearing.
Thank you, sir. I was hoping you would react that way. Father, I've taken the liberty of inviting Jonathan Caleb here to meet the Count of Monte Cristo.
Maud, you did not dare. After I had forbidden that harebrained dreamer entry into this home, or to have any further association with my daughter?
Yes, Father, I did. For I know that Jonathan's dreams hold the answer to America's present problems. and to a future of unlimited prosperity and abundance for her.
When Jonathan Caleb arrived, I found him to be a stalwart young man with a suntanned skin and far-seeing eyes of a sailor. And within those eyes could be seen burning the fierce fires of some glorious dream. Shortly afterwards, while Rennie escorted Maud for a walk in the gardens, Jonathan Caleb disclosed that dream to me.
There's only one answer to America's present financial crisis, sir. As long as British ships have prior treaty rights, our ships must be able to sail from China 3 weeks to 3 months after the British have weighed anchor and still beat them into American and European ports.
A rather fantastic conception, is it not, Jonathan? From what I've seen, the ships sailing out of Boston today are the most modern ever built. They cannot make the trip to Canton in less than 6 months. Approximately the same length of time as the British.
Of course they can, sir, because those tubs aren't designed for speed. That's what's needed. Speed and more speed. Ships that can reach Canton in 3 months instead of six. Ships that will have double the speed of any bottoms on the seas today.
You're not talking about ships now, Caleb. You're talking about flying clouds.
I'm talking about clipper ships, Mr. Banion. Yankee clipper ships.
That can never be built.
That can and must be built, sir.
These Yankee clipper ships you speak of, Jonathan, are they any more than dreams, or have you reduced them to more practical terms?
I have a model built, sir, and a complete set of sketches and plans. Mr. Banion has already seen them.
I've seen them, all right, and so has every other ship owner in America.
And your opinion?
They're not the plans of a ship, but of a knife blade.
Then it's a knife blade that can sail faster than 18 knots, sir.
On paper, perhaps, yes. But put a ship 250 feet long and only 40 feet wide in the water, you sink like the steel in that knife. No count, whatever the answer to our shipping problem might be, it certainly doesn't lie in this crackpot dream of Caleb's.
Yet, in theory at least, Jonathan's solution is sound. If such a fleet of clipper ships could be built, ships that could outsail anything on the seven seas today, 2 knots to 1. Why, Jonathan, I should like very much to see your model of this Yankee clipper. The next morning, I saw that model of Jonathan's ship, the ship about which he had built such wonderful dreams and hopes. She was a strange ship, unlike any afloat, bird-like in her graceful sweeping lines, taut and eager like an arrow quivering with ill-concealed impatience to speed from the drawn bow, in a burst of snow-white canvas carried by her three masts and fine rigging, looked like clouds floating above the clean lines of her form. She was indeed a ship to be loved, a dream ship.
Well, sir, what do you think of her? Is she not everything that I said she would be?
Jonathan, you've found your backer. We are going to build her. We are going to build the first Yankee clipper. It was in the shipping yards at Newport that her keel was laid. The keel of a ship that was to be 250 feet long and only 40 feet wide. A ship that was to have three masts and carry more canvas than had been held aloft by bottoms of twice her tonnage. There was no lack of onlookers as the long, clean lines of her shape developed and grew. Nor was there a lack of scoffers as professional shipbuilder and an amateur sailor alike proclaimed to the world his opinion of her.
Full ship's rigging on the hull of a racing sloop, why, it's ridiculous. You'll capsize at the first breath of wind.
What chance did those masts have against the gales of the Horn?
That hull can't even be launched without sinking.
Where's the cargo capacity? Mark my words. That length and no beam, she'll dive into the first wave to come along and never be seen again.
Yes, there were scoffers aplenty, watching and sneering as the hull of the ship grew beautiful and true. But their jeers and jibes fell on deaf ears as Jonathan Rennie and I bent our every effort toward completing the steamship. Efforts that suddenly seemed to be hampered and harassed at every turn.
Well, monsieur, things are going smoothly enough at the present, despite the rigid schedule you and Jonathan have set. She's being completed well ahead of it.
If so, Rennie, thanks are due solely to James Cromby, our master shipwright. Without him, our difficulties would have been multiplied 100-fold. So long as Cromby is there, we can be sure to have a...
Monsieur, that timber collapsed. And there's a man pinned beneath it.
Yes, Rennie, I see. A man whose name is James Cromby.
I brought Maud over to see how the work is progressing, Edmond. I trust you don't mind.
Mind? When she was the one really responsible for this partnership? I'm delighted to see you again, mademoiselle.
Thank you. My father would be furious if he ever learned about it, but... Well, I just couldn't stay away. Oh, she's going to be a beautiful ship, Jonathan.
If we ever get her finished, Maud. The way accidents have been occurring...
We shall get her finished, Jonathan. We have but to complete her decking and set the mast, and she'll be ready. What?
Oh! Oh, no!
Despite all the jeers, despite a series of hampering accidents, Jonathan Caleb's dream finally became a reality. One day the ship, proudly flying the colors of the Caleb Shipping Company, was ready to entrust herself to the restless bosom of the sea. And as Jonathan Rennie and I stood on her deck with a handful of sailors, Maud Banyan, from the high scaffolding at her prow, gave the ship her name.
Jonathan, my darling, I want you to know that I christen your ship with my whole being, praying for her and your success. I name thee Flying Cloud.
The sledges hammered out the shock blocks, slowly at first, and with gathering speed, with an eager rush, the Flying Cloud sped down the waves toward the arms of the expectantly awaiting sea.
Oh, Edmond. Edmond, we've done it. She's afloat. She's afloat.
Indeed, yes, monsieur. And she rides the water as gracefully as what she is. A flying cloud.
Yes, my friend. The first Yankee clipper has been lost, with the hopes of a nation riding the proud wings of her canvas. She has to prove herself yet, but when she does, she... Wait. Do you notice anything peculiar about the deck, my friend?
The deck, monsieur? Why, no, Edmund, I can't.
The deck is beginning to slope down toward the prow. There's something wrong. She's no longer riding on even keel.
She's floundering, Jonathan. Going down for the head.
We'll continue with the Count of Monte Cristo in just a moment. You know, no war can only be half won, and the war against the dread killer tuberculosis is like any other war. We must conquer it completely in order to be safe from its ravages. Christmas Seals have been fighting against tuberculosis for 43 years now, and in that time, great battles have been won. Modern techniques of case finding by X-ray surveys, improved medical treatment and health education, all combine to prevent the spread of tuberculosis. The death rate has been cut as much as 80%, but this is not enough. Tuberculosis still strikes at thousands of Americans. It can strike at you, for it is a communicable disease. And you and your home, at your job, or your children at school may be exposed to it. So help wipe out. The war can be won if we all fight against it. You can do your part so easily by just sending your check today for the Christmas gift and use your Christmas seal generously on all your holiday mail.
Now, Edmond, I ask your advice regarding this loan to America, and you waste my time with this ridiculous story about some flying cloud.
Again, I assure you, sire, that it has the most pertinent bearing upon the matter at hand. For in Jonathan Caleb's clipper ship rested the last hopes of the United States for a restoration of its shipping industry.
Faint hopes indeed, Edmond. When you say that she foundered and sank immediately upon launching...
Your pardon, sire, but I said only that she was going down to the head. And it was obvious by the way she was acting that she was taking in water forward. We rushed below decks and into the forward cargo hold.
Edmund, do you see where that water's coming from? Someone's poured holes under the bow bulkhead.
Yes, sir, Campbell. Woodcraft, Wedge's car. Drive them into those holes with caulking hammers. They'll serve as temporary plugs until we make permanent repairs. Hurry now, the flying car may yet be saved.
And save the flying cloud we did. Permanent repairs were quickly made, and then we took her out for a trial run. Her performance was a thing of beauty. She answered to the wheel as though anticipating every thought of the helmsman, rode the waves with the ease and grace of a swallow, and showed bursts of speed that brought literal gasps of admiration from those of us aboard her. Trial runs over, we began preparing for the maiden voyage to China, and then found we would have trouble getting a crew. For the word had spread that the flying car was a death ship that could never survive the journey. The very night before we were scheduled to sail, we had but a skeleton crew and no first mate. We were discussing it in Jonathan's office. Come in.
This is Jonathan Caleb.
Yes, that's right.
I'm Red Off. I hear you're looking for a first mate.
Yes, I am. Are you looking for such a berth?
Aye, if she's a ship bound for the China trade.
Why do you specify that, Mr. Harper?
Well, sir, I've been sailing on China packets for the past 10 years. I could find my way to Canton in a rowboat with my eyes closed. I'd sort of be lost doing anything else.
You have your mate's ticket with you, Mr. Harker?
Aye. Here's my papers.
Yes, they seem to be in good order, Edmund. Then I suggest we take a chance on Mr. Harkness, if he's willing to sign on.
You just hired yourself a first mate, huh? And one who can drive a crew of lazy sailors better than any men afloat.
We like our men to work, Harkness, but we don't bully them.
Oh, yes, I understand, sir. And you don't have to worry about a thing. With Red Harkness aboard his first mate, things will run through this too. Good night, gents.
And so it was with the next morning's tide, short-handed, and with Red Hawk as his first mate, the flying car began her journey to far-off China.
Break up canvas, Mr. Harkness.
All right, sir.
And as Jonathan's first command cracked out and the lovely, billowing white sheets of her canvas shook themselves into the open and bellied out before the fresh morning wind, reaching for the far horizon, the flying cloud began her maiden voyage. The voyage which was to prove whether the hopes and prayers that went into her building were justified, or if she were merely the impractical result of a dreamer's visionary mind. Heading south into the stormy Atlantic went the brave, slender bow of the flying cloud, with all canvas set, and breast of fair weather and a strong, steady wind. Her knife-like prow cut through the waves at ever-increasing speed. Faster and faster she sped,
passing ship after ship that she'd left Boston weeks before. Down over the equator and south to Cape Horn. Around the Cape she beat her way and then pointed her nose toward far distant China.
And then, early one morning, when she's been at sea for just 3 months, from the lookout high in the crow's nest came a hail.
Harkness.
Lynn sighted dead edge, sir. And unless I miss my guess, it'll be canned tone.
Did you hear that, Edmund? We've done it. We'll be in Canton by nightfall. Just 92 days out of Boston.
For 3 weeks, the Flying Cloud, fastest ship on the seven seas, was forced to remain idle at anchor in Canton, waiting for the British ships to take their choice of cargo and to weigh anchor at their leisure. But finally, we were able to load cargo aboard and set sail eagerly for the journey home. But now the gods of fortune who had been smiling at us suddenly turned their faces away. Just 2 days out of Canton, as the ship moved fitfully before a faint early morning breeze, there came a frightening call.
Pirates off the port bow! Pirates off the port bow!
Pirates! Bosun! Hype all hands on deck!
Attack was finally beaten off, and again the Flying Cloud went on, more short-handed than ever by now. And then the crew began to get rest early because of Red Harkness's bullying that went on behind our backs.
Get your back to his side. You know, if they put your back to a rope, you lazy dog, put your back to it.
Throw a bucket of scupper water over him, that will bring him to.
But our troubles were far from over. Monsoons blew us off course. Blizzards and headwinds beset us as we beat around the horn. And then as we headed north once again, a fierce squall began to shake us at its feet.
With a re-sail, Mr. Kiley.
No need, Mr. Harkness. She's written our foot towards the mist,
but she's carrying a full leg of Cambridge.
She can carry it. She's done it before.
I warned you, Mr. Tidy. License and topsail sails clean away.
Wear the decks and rig, jury masts and spare canvas at once, Harkness. Then crack on full sail. There's nothing going to stop us now.
And nothing did. For as the Flying Cloud carried on, began to feel the strength and power of the favorable trade winds, she skimmed over the sea like a swallow. And then, just 88 days out of Canton, she dropped anchor in Boston Harbor. That night, we were all gathered once again around the dining table at the home of Warren Bunyan, But this time the atmosphere was vastly different from what it had been upon the occasion of our last visit there.
I'm not ashamed to confess it, Count. Not to you or Jonathan or the world. I was a dunderheaded, stubborn old fool without the sense that God gave me.
No apologies are necessary, Monsieur Banion. All that matters is that you and the other American ship owners have found out the way out of your financial straits, thanks to Jonathan Caleb and his flying cloud.
No. No, Edmund. Any thanks that are due are rightfully yours.
Jonathan is right, sir. For without your faith, there might be little future for this country of ours. But now, well, soon there'll be 100 clipper ships like the flying cloud, bringing prosperity back to these shores once again.
Some hours later, Rennie and I left our happy friends at the Banion home and made our way toward the docks. For some reason, I felt restless and ill at ease, concerned in some strange way about the flying cloud. And though I knew that both Harkness and the sailor Williams were standing watch aboard her that night, I had to make certain that all was well.
Now that is strange, monsieur. Where are the lookouts? One would think they would have challenged us as we came aboard.
One would indeed, René. Now I'm more convinced than ever that...
Monsieur, that sound.
Over there, René, lying at the foot of the mainmast.
It's Williams, bound and gagged. Mm-hmm. Here, I'd best take off that gag.
No time for that now, Rennie. Let's get below and quickly.
You soak right there, James.
Well, it... Harkness. And look, monsieur. He has oil soaked rags and that candle. Is it possible that...
Yes, Rennie. He apparently intends to start a little bonfire.
Bonfire? You mean he intends to set fire to the flying... Well, we'll soon put a stop to
that. Easy, Michon, easy. No sense stopping any lead sooner than you have to.
He means that, Rennie.
Yes, but, monsieur, we
can't... It was evident long ago that someone was attempting to destroy the flying cloud, Rennie. The accident, the knife-cut rigging that carried away in the storm, possibly even the pirate attack, were all... part and parcel of the same overall plan.
But why, monsieur? Why?
Someone with an interest to protect had intelligence enough to realize what clipper ships meant, Rennie. The threat they presented to the British shipping industry. So Harkness was hired to see that the threat did not materialize.
That's right, Monte Cristo. You got off lucky so far. But 5 minutes from now, this pretty little ship and its cargo are going up in smoke.
That won't stop a Yankee clipper fleet from being built, Harkness. It won't stop me, Harkness.
Give me that gun,
Harkness.
That beat to have it.
Yes, again, Monte Cristo. This time you're going to get it like you should have long ago.
Monsieur the Comte.
I'm all right, Rennie.
But Harkness is...
Yes, Rennie, I managed to turn the muzzle toward him just as he fired.
You're badly hurt, monsieur. That first shot of his...
Just a flesh wound, Rennie. The marlin spike I hurled deflected his aim just enough. Well, my friend, let us return to the inn. And tomorrow we'll set sail for France. It would seem that our little business trip to the United States has been successfully concluded. And there, sire, is the story of adventure I beg leave to tell. I think you will agree that it solves completely the problem that has troubled your court. There can be no doubt now as to the advisability of a loan to the United States. For Jonathan Caleb's dream has come true. And the Flying Cloud and hundreds of other Yankee clippers, speeding like winged birds over the bosoms of the seven seas, are going to lift America from the sloughs of depression into the sunlight of decades of prosperity, until she eventually becomes the strongest, most powerful democratic ally that France will ever have upon the face of this earth.
Carlton Young will return in just a moment. You know, there are a lot of places for your money these days, but there's no better place for some of it than in United States savings bonds. Yes, United States savings bonds. Let's look into them for a minute. You pay $18.75, and you get back $25 on maturity. In other words, in 10 short years, that's $4 for every three you put in now. Fine interest in a safe, sound investment. With your money in United States savings bonds, friends, you can look to the future with confidence. Yes, they're wonderful things to own a lot of. United States savings bonds. Buy them at any bank or post office, or use one of the convenient plans for buying savings bonds automatically. For example, the payroll savings plan where you might work, or a bond a month plan where you happen to bank. Make your future shining bright with United States savings bonds. Ladies and gentlemen, the star of our program, Carlton Young.
Thank you, Charles. Next week, friends, the Count and Rene journey to peaceful Stratford-on-Avon, where they encounter a glamorous princess, a rare Shakespearean manuscript, and murder. Join us, won't you? Until then, good night.